Linux Show, and it's 8:05 here in the wonderful city of Chicago, Illinois. It is Tuesday, the 27th of April, 2004, and we are bringing you another edition of the Linux Show, broadcasting live every Tuesday night. We have a little housekeeping before we bring in the panel. I'd like to make a couple announcements, make a couple requests of the people in our listening audience before we get started. First of all, we'd like some suggestions from y'all. If you are not yet signed up, we are asking that you go to our website, www.thelinuxshow.com, and you will see a link for our email list. We're going to do something unusual on our email list this week. We're going to dialogue with those people who are actually signed up for the list. We're going to ask some questions about some changes that we're going to be making in the format of the way that we do things as we move up to making our PBX go live. It's going to be happening fairly soon. So we'd like some advice from the listener audience as to how to go about doing this. So if you'd like to participate in the conversation, go to our website, www.thelinuxshow.com, and sign up for our email list. Normally we don't send out very many emails on that list, just a notification a couple hours before showtime on Tuesday afternoon. But this one time we're going to make special use of it. Another announcement that we'll be making is we're in the need, or at least I'm in the need, of a French-speaking person. And so if you happen to be one of our Canadian audience in French Canada, please drop me an email at jeff@thelinuxshow.com. Can't talk exactly what this is all in reference to right at the moment. The surprise is coming up for a couple of months from now. But if you happen to speak a little French and might be interested in helping out with a special project with The Linux Show, drop me a line, jeff@thelinuxshow.com. The panel is here, at least mostly here tonight. Doc seems to be MIA. He may be on plane as we speak and unable to talk with us. That's the conjecture at the moment, that his flight has made it impossible for him to join us tonight. But we'll find out. We'll be having somebody check on that status as the next hour goes on, and we'll fill you in. But the rest of the panel is here out in California. Is Arnie Flonis. How are you tonight, Arnie?
Well, pretty good. Your call, I was taking a nap, and so I was dozed off, and luckily I heard the phone. But it's nice here. We have record heat here, though, over 100.
Really?
And so I got the air. Maybe you can hear the hum of my air conditioner going in my office here.
100 degrees in April.
Way over. It's like 105 or more. It's
but
like
it's
really hot. So you probably hear the air conditioner roaring in the background here.
Yes, I do. That's okay. We'll let you keep it playing. It's an essential at this moment.
Yep.
Helping you to keep your sanity.
It keeps the net winder from melting down.
And that's important.
Oh, yeah, it's my DNS, man. I can't have that melting down. So.
And out on the other end of the country, at least I think you're in the other end of the country, is Russ Pavlicek. How are you doing tonight, Russ?
Oh, I'm hanging in. I'm definitely in the other end, the end known as New Jersey.
There's a variety of ends that's been called before.
But, it's actually quite nice here, and I happen to be in Jersey City enjoying the view of lower Manhattan from across the water. So it's not bad, not bad. Doing work out here.
Sounds lovely.
Actually, Jersey City has gotten a lot better over the years. It seems like when I was young, it was rather depressing, but it's turned rather upscale these days.
They're yuppifying Jersey City, huh?
That's it. That's it. Of course, there's a lot of the big financial firms have a presence over here, and it's not unusual to find, especially since September 11th, sort of dual offices from New York and New Jersey as sort of a redundancy issue should there be another event that takes place.
And how are you tonight, Kevin?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good.
Oh, that's good. Everything up and running fine?
Seems to be, more or less.
Yeah,
I'm experimenting with some new software, but not quite working yet, so we're back to using the old stuff again.
You're referring to the Icecast?
Yep.
Yep. Well, yeah, there's a bunch of changes that we're going to be putting through in terms of some management software over the course of the next few weeks in doing... when you have a PBX coming online, there's new issues that face you, things like call screening and stuff like that. And we're just starting now to play around with some new call screening applications. They're going to allow the entire panel to take a look at who's on hold and get a little heads-up cue on the people. So it'll be interesting over the course of the next couple weeks as the software evolves. Let's go ahead and jump on into segment number one. And I'm going to go ahead and hand it off to you, Arnie, because I've got to change telephones. My battery pack's going dead as we speak. I should have charged it before the show, but didn't think of it. So why don't you go ahead and start talking, and I'll do a quick phone handoff while you're talking about your first story.
Yeah, I think maybe what I'll do first here is to comment on the Desktop Linux Summit that was in Del Mar, California last week. Doc and I met down there, and we spent the day down there. Doc was probably down there for 2 days, but I was there for 1 day. And this is, of course, Lindows.com's desktop little mini summit, little mini exposition. And there were probably a few hundred people in attendance, and there was a few dozen, very few dozen, maybe 30 or 40 exhibitors. Some of the biggies there were Novell was there, Sun was there, LPI was there, a few other people. We're going to have some upcoming guests on the show from that expo, including probably NetTraverse, who's the people, the Win for Lynn people, and a few others. But this was not as much as an expo booth expo as it was a people gave talks on a variety of desktop issues. The main message of the show came out of Europe. What's happening in Europe is that Linux is, of course, taking great strides to lots of success in Linux adaptations in Europe. But where it's going is kind of interesting. Apparently, we're seeing a lot of thin client implementations, and this was news to me. I mean, I always knew about thin clients, but I never anticipated that desktop Linux might be going there. And that is kind of what's happening in Europe and the third world countries, for the simple fact it allows people to leverage inexpensive hardware. And also, you know, when we talk about total cost of ownership, thin client certainly does save a lot of money. Also, they're talking about corporate computers a lot. And with thin client technology, you can have a computer that's very, very small, only provides the services you need, and basically, you know, thin is in. There's a couple articles I've highlighted, links on the website. One is called Thinning Down the Desktop, Linux Desktop, which is a report from SearchEnterpriseLinux.com by Amy Kucerich, assistant editor, who was also at the show. I didn't talk to her at the show, but I talked to some of the same people that she talked to. One was Louis Nagy, president of a new Paris-based company called Microcost. That's cost, not soft. Who's using thin client in third world countries. Another one is Brandt Kretsch, no, it's really hard to pronounce this name, Kretschmer, who's been working with in Germany to put implementations of Linux desktop, and again is also using thin client. One of the things that interesting, I talked to Bernd Kretschmer, and he seems to think that he's been putting together some numbers on the penetration of Linux in the desktop, and he thinks that Gartner and everybody else's numbers are completely wrong. Inability to measure that, difficulty to measure the saturation. He seems to think it's maybe 6% or more, possibly more. I talked to him about being on the show too, and he showed some interest as well. And he's a journalist who's actually has done some research on this.
And he's from France?
Germany.
Okay.
Very interesting. He's a co-author of a German language book, Linux Terminal Server.
I was about to say that this entire thread really is just a continuation off of the buzz that started at Linux World Expo. Everybody anticipated that there was going to be a lot of buzz about Linux on the desktop in December, but what was surprising when you actually got to Linux World Expo in January was the number of people who had taken the Linux Terminal Server project and had done something with it in terms of coming up with a business thin client type application. There are certainly a significant number of them, and I'm not at all surprised that this is the buzz at the desktop summit.
Well, this was the major buzz, and basically what these guys are saying, there was a great big panel on this, and there were four people, five, including the moderator, five people, and they all in TLS was that's not the Linux show, TLS or Linux Terminal Service. LTS. LTS was the main technology, and no one talked about anything else. And one of the things that Bernd said that was interesting is that the United States doesn't feel this trend too much because there's too much money available here. What's really wagging this, the tail that's wagging this dog, is the extreme lack of money in Europe and in the third world country to implement IT infrastructure, and because of that, it's basically just a financial thing. Mm-hmm. And what they're finding is that the terminal services work so well and are so great for a company to control their internet technology that there's all sorts of gains being seen, and so that's what the people are implementing these things are finding that this is really 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 a good solution,
and this also kind of drives to the heart of why so many of the analysts aren't going to pick up on this. Because rather than thinking in terms of product, in terms of who's going to make money, of what the profit margins are going to be, and all this sort of stuff, here's something that's just a mold breaker. It's taking old stuff, making it work very well, doing it for low cost. No one's getting rich, but lots of people are benefiting. And quite frankly, there's a lot of stuff going on, a lot of thinking going on in the analyst worldview that doesn't account for something like this. where it's not product driven, it's not profit driven, but it's actually delivering a great deal of power using largely recycled elements.
And really, even when it's not driving a recycled element, it is driving something that is a completely foreign model to what the IT industry is using. I mean, let's look at the example of Sun. It's really hard to comprehend that Sun is going to try and do the thin client boxes they're talking about in China, because it is such a wholesale departure from their high-margin, big-box tradition.
Well, apparently they are doing some stuff, though. I mean, apparently they're having some success with it, because they were there talking about their thin client solutions, too.
They're producing products. Let's not say that they're having success yet.
I might say that Novell certainly fits in fairly well because of their network services is certainly stretchable to the thin client and works very well that way. And because what we're talking about is having custom and small, lots of small and custom in-house software leveraged to the Linux thin client, and we're just talking about a user interface away from a lot of applications just being ported.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because basically the back office stuff is already there.
Yeah,
maybe on NetWare.
But from a technical standpoint, the most sophisticated thing you really need to pull off a workable thin client for a business application is a audio codec that can do 24 bit sound. And that's just not a lot of horsepower. That's a relatively, nominal amount of horsepower.
And plus, a lot of these aren't using legacy hardware. A lot of it's using new hardware, and they're saving money because they don't have to do. They don't have to. All they need is memory, CPU, and a NIC, and they're in business.
And a sound card.
Well, sound card and video.
Well,
the sound cards are cheap.
Yeah. Well, the sound card is a much more critical element than it was even being talked about at the desktop summit.
Yeah, but you can get a Sound Blaster Audio 128 for less than $30 bucks.
No, you need VoIP compatible codecs, and a good Sound Blaster will do that, but not a Sound Blaster 16.
That's not a Sound Blaster 16. That's a PCI. Sound Blaster. I have one in one of my machines.
But so you need
it's full duplex.
You need to be able to do the absolute full duplex in real time.
Yeah.
In order to pull off VoIP. And although it hasn't become the mission critical application yet, a year from now that will be the mission critical application that's going to make or break thin client. At least that's my opinion. So very interesting. Anything else about the conference? You said this is a major thing. Well, what was the minor thing?
Oh, there's some minor things too. There's a new game outfit. Linux gaming outfit was there in large force. Let's see. I think if you go onto the Linux Desktop Linux Summit website, you can get their, excuse me, I'm going to sneeze. No, I'm not. Okay. They were running some gaming stuff there. Ian Murdoch was there. I missed his talk. But he was talking about desktop Linux, of course, in conjunction with Debian. Also, the second day, there were a few other people that were really good that I didn't get to see. The other thing that was big was Lindows.com is put out some new audio stuff called Lintunes, which is basically basically their version of Apple Tunes, or what do they call it, iTunes or whatever, iTunes. And that was very successful. Everybody was crowding around that booth. In fact, there's an article been posted recently here about that, about those their audio stuff that hit the press since I posted my stories. And you might want to go on the normal Linux news sites and fish around for iTunes and see if and look into that. That was looked very interesting. Doc seemed to be in tune with that fairly well. He spent quite a bit of time at that booth.
Oh, Doc loves gadgets. He was probably trying to get his Windows laptop fixed too.
Yeah, I know that because he had it. It's kind of a little tiny laptop, and
yeah, he picked one of those up at a conference though about a year ago, and ran into a problem. Oh, I don't know, a couple weeks after he got it, and that immutable doc fashion, he, you know, put it down and meant to get it fixed, and just sat there for almost a year.
He had it there, and he was. Oh, and we talked to Michael Robertson. And,
you did?
Yeah, and talked to the Lindos people.
Were they talking about the IPO at all?
Oh, of course, they can't talk about that. But
Robertson not talking about anything to me seems to be a lot.
Well, they're in that period where they have to be quiet. So I asked him if he wanted to come on the Linux show, and he said he'd love to. So. Sure, there we go.
We'll see.
Well, but he was in front of all his employees, and you know.
We'll see if he actually will come on. No, I'm glad you asked him. But I think it's really interesting what is happening over there at Lindos. The timing of the IPO. We might as well, you know, segue into the Lindos IPO because I sort of wanted to talk about it. This makes a couple of major IPOs that are coming up fairly quickly within the big time IT and open source communities. Of course, we got the big IPO at Google coming up shortly. And this IPO at Lindos, if you're not aware of the kind of IPO that Lindos is doing, Lindos is going to be using that open IPO, which is available to anybody. If you go to IPO.org, I believe it might be IPO.net, don't take my word for it. So go to Google and search open IPO, and I'm sure you'll find it. But Lindos decided to take the formula of using the open IPO technique, because for those companies that have qualified for it, and mind you, the qualifications for doing this open IPO are, believe it or not, less stringent than the SEC's requirements for doing a IPO on one of the big boards. So it's a little more doable for a small company that's not posting sales in the millions of dollars to pull off an IPO. Probably the most famous of the open IPOs was the what was their name? The guys who bought Slashdot. Why did my mind go blank?
That would be VA.
No, not VA. This is before VA.
Oh, okay.
Andover.
Andover.
Yeah, Andover. No, Andover did an open IPO. And oh, hi, Eric, by the way.
Hi.
But Andover did an IPO, and surprise, surprise, they raised $85 million on a handful of portals. This was before they even bought Slashdot, and then they used those funds to buy Slashdot, and then used that combined entity to purchase from VA. So a number of companies have used this technique pretty successfully for limited IPOs, so you're, you know, looking to raise less than $100 million. And from what I've heard, Lindo's only wants to raise like 50 or 60 million bucks. That's all they want.
That's not much by VC standards.
No, it's not.
We had a tour of their headquarters too. Doc and I went up there, and they had a insiders tour. And so we went up. They had pizza, and we went up there and got the tour, and we talked to a few people. And it's kind of interesting. It's all one open room, all on one floor, and you know, just full of lots of expensive cubicle stuff. And I guess they got that for a song, because basically the company that had bought all the furniture and stuff, furnishings and stuff, was going Chapter 11 or something, Chapter something at any rate, and had them vacate the premises, and with all the, and didn't have money to store the furniture, so they basically made a sweet deal, and Robertson picked it up for a song, and so they were already outfit and ready to go, and they have a pretty nice little outfit there, and it's just one huge long space, and a wide open space. And
well, there's an irony for you right there, because ironically, you know, if you could find places for your employees to live, right now, at least according to the article I read in San Francisco Times about a week or so ago, right now it's an incredibly economical time in the history of Silicon Valley to open up a new business, because you've got an incredible amount of office space that's being unused. You've got, just like you said, all kinds of office furniture and computers and Xerox machines just piled everywhere, from companies that were former dot-com companies that had gone bust. So there's just tons of equipment laying around that nobody's using. And there's lots of people there are still underemployed. And so if you can actually afford to live there, they're touting Silicon Valley again as a great place, great opportunity to actually start up a company economically. But the real estate issue is just the problem. That's sort of an interesting phenomenon that's happening that Robertson has actually tuned in on.
Too bad, yeah, and too bad you can't get buy a house in the area for under a third of $1 million.
Well, that's what I was just saying. that's what I was saying. If you could find a place for your employees to live.
Yeah, either that or you got to pay them a lot of money.
Yeah.
When I was up in Silicon Valley a few years ago, one of the problems they were having was is basically people buying up, renting apartments and teaming up three to four to apartment. Basically, crowded conditions under even the best of conditions in order to live in the area and work in the area. They couldn't afford to buy.
Almost millionaires.
Well, they weren't millionaires. They were basically the grunts, you know, and they were teaming up four or five to an apartment, you know, just in order to be able to afford to live there. Too bad. You know, all the gentrification up there is pretty bad.
Let's go ahead and get into the rest of your stories on your list.
Well, I have one or two. One of the other ones that I found interesting is a sunny forecast for open source. And this cites weather.com, which 4 years ago moved their whole operation over to open source non-commodity software, and based in Atlanta. Of course, they're connected to CNN and I think those other outfits, or used to be anyway. And they're using WebSphere and IBM technology, and that's kind of a really in-depth article. They go through, it's from Computer World, and they basically go into quite a bit of detail on and how much, you know, they do 30 million database calls a day, and that's quite a bit. And of course, with the graphics and all the technology behind forecasting weather, they found that Linux is serving their needs. And one of the things they mentioned is support is being superior, which is interesting.
On the thin client side, there's a report from Toronto with the Capital Cardiology Associates, and they're doing the thin client thing for doctors. And I always thought that a narrow vertical market, like doctor, lawyer, you know, any type of vertical market where you're going to use one or two applications very, very heavily, that the thin client type of implementation would be a useful thing. You know, like government, education, that kind of thing. And apparently, this cardiology group in Toronto has found that the benefits of thin client. And that's about all I had today.
Okay, Russ, do you have a couple articles for us?
Yeah, I've got a few. Once again, all out at the Linux Show website. One from a source called Hi Pakistan, and it's talking about how a project has been launched to train 4,000 people in open source software. You know, we talked about how so many things are happening because of cost when you start getting out beyond America. And this is one that kind of lays it all on the line, that they realize they need to improve technology. They need to be able to do it without bankrupting the country. And so they've decided that the best way that that they can participate is by training people in the use and development of open source software. So it's an interesting piece, and being a very regional piece, you know, it adds a little bit of local flair to it all, shall we say. It lets you see a perspective that sometimes we in North America don't get to see too often. So I thought that was rather neat.
And where is this taking place?
Pakistan, I believe.
Oh, Pakistan. So all the jobs that are presently being outsourced to India will get outsourced to Pakistan?
Pakistan's going to outsource them to where?
Goodness knows.
Malaysia.
But, you know, the outsourcing will happen regardless. At least these people have an idea of which way they're supposed to go.
Hey, you know what? Not necessarily always. That's always the case. Did you hear about what happened at the IBM Board of Directors meeting this past week?
I didn't know.
I thought this was remarkable. A stockholders group got together a significant number of proxies to come to the floor and present a directive to the board of directors to have the board of directors rethink the announcements that they had made a month ago in their in next year's fiscal operating plan. They were projecting outsourcing a number of existing jobs to places like India and Malaysia. And the board of directors, this was a significant percentage of stockholders that were saying, you know, we love the dividends, we love the profits, but we really want you to rethink this before you actually follow through on it. So IBM has not yet made a decision, but they may very well be backing off of their outsourcing announcement. This would be an interesting story to see how IBM is going to tap dance their mixed responsibilities, as you know, their obligations to their stockholders, which are worldwide, and their obligations to the country where they were founded. It's a mixed bag of loyalties. It's going to be interesting to see how IBM deals with this and see if they can come up with a unique solution. IBM's a clever company, and I'm going to be watching this to see what they come up with. But on to your next story.
Yeah, well, by the way, too, that is going to be interesting to watch over time. would be very good if they come up with a better alternative. Next story.
It is from the standpoint that Microsoft is profitable, and part of the reason I should have said this, part of the reason why they were going to do this outdoor thing was to increase dividends. That was the reason, was to increase dividends. And the stockholders were saying, you know what, we'll forgo the dividend if you'll keep the jobs in the United States. That's a ballsy thing for the stockholders to say.
Of course, stockholders could also say, like, let's outsource the CIO job, CEO job. Outsource CEO.
I don't think that's likely to happen.
No.
Well, you're right, it's happened. We got the Disney case to fall back on. The stockholders can revolt, but...
stockholders are revolting.
Go ahead, Russ.
And yeah, you're pretty revolting yourself.
Yes.
You recognize the musical? Never mind.
Thank you, Eric. there's an interesting very little piece over at idg.com.sg. A little piece from IDG News Service, their Australia Bureau. And it talks about how folks over at IDC Research are predicting a significant decline in Windows. Here we go with my brain again, with a significant decline in the percentage that Windows will have inside the desktop market in the near future. It's interesting that they say now. I'm trying to see what the actual region is that they're trying to project here, but they say that Microsoft currently has around 90%. So obviously, this isn't just U.S. that they're talking about.
When did they drop from 92?
Excuse me?
When did they drop from 92? That's the estimate I've been used to hearing for a number of years.
Yeah, well, this one says that it currently has around 90%, but IDC is apparently expecting it will fall to 58% by 2007.
Interesting.
You know, it's an interesting thing how this is going to fall out. Now, they're talking about how the impact will also have to do with the arrival of smartphones and things of this sort, which will take on some of the desktop-ish functions. But it's just an interesting take, especially since so many people have been saying for so long that, oh, you know, Microsoft is, you know, the king forever and ever, amen. Well, that doesn't seem to be the case anymore here. There's actually significant declines being projected here. And it's going to be very, very interesting.
One of the things that I don't understand about this article is they say the server market will remain mixed with variants of Unix accounting for 36%, Windows 35, and Linux 15.
Yeah.
I was under the assumption that Linux was a variant of Unix.
And of course, the other piece of it, too, is that, and I have a feeling that some of this has to do with regional numbers, because, quite frankly, you know, I can remember even a few years ago the Linux percentage being much closer to what they're saying for Unix.
Yes.
So I have a feeling that a lot of this is regional, but it's an interesting piece, and it's heartening in some respects to see the numbers dropping the way that they're talking about. It's a new world coming, folks. Adjust now. It's good for you.
Yeah. Well, a lot of this. The numbers in this article, though, are sort of misleading because if you're really going to be totally fair about the numbers, you not only have to break them out by market, but when you're talking about embedded systems, you're talking about anything from a desktop to computer to a smartphone to an intelligent toaster. And there are already, if you haven't seen them, there are already refrigerators with a RJ45 jack in them that are being sold at Best Buy.
And Microsoft is going to get barely any of that market.
Yeah, and they're not.
because it pushes up the unit cost of the device too much.
Right.
Good. But I'll be able to tell how cold my beer is from any part in the world, anywhere in the world.
Well, maybe, but that's not what the function of these jacks are. The function of the jacks is for the servicing company, you know, Frigidaire or whoever, to do remote diagnostics of the device so that they can send in a tech if needed, or just mail you a computer card, you know, roll the refrigerator out away from the wall and plug in a new card. That's going to be the future of large appliance maintenance. You're going to have a bus in the back of your appliances, and you're going to pop daughter cards and do a lot of your own maintenance.
And sure as shooting, we're going to have websites run by Linux hackers who are going to be reverse engineering the protocols on these things. It's going to be entertaining.
Oh, yeah, it is. You're going to have refrigerators microwaving popcorn, I'm sure.
Don't forget about the conspiracy theorists.
Yeah.
What they'll do with that.
But my point in all this is the more Linux that are deployed in a wide variety of devices, these numbers are going to skew way off the scale. But if you just segment it off into PDAs, laptops, and PCs, I think it's going to be a long time before you see Microsoft's numbers drop into the range of 58%. I just don't foresee that happening. Maybe by the end of the decade, but not by 2007.
On the other hand, one of my favorite quotes from a work of fiction that happens to be about real history is from one of the Hornblower novels, where Captain Hornblower runs into the French count, who explains the fact that he's working against Napoleon by saying, "Empires both rise and fall in geometrical progression. They don't rise and collapse linearly." And I thought that was a fascinating statement, and I had to think about why that might be true for a while, and eventually I figured it out, and it's strongly relevant to the dynamics of the markets that Microsoft is in. It's because when people are evaluating an empire or a monopoly, a lot of their confidence in the empire or the monopoly comes from the belief that it's always going to be strong because other people think it's always going to be strong. So they're doing their evaluation of the empire partly by what the attitudes around them are. That means there's a built-in nonlinearity. When the empire starts to collapse, one of the things that happens is the average level of confidence goes down, and people see that in the other people who are doing evaluations around them. So there's a positive feedback. So what I'm saying is, I'm sorry, this was kind of an elaborate divagation. There's reason to believe from real history that once Microsoft's collapse actually starts, it will happen quite quickly.
I've heard that one before too.
Yeah, it's possible. I don't see the buggy whip phenomenon happening at Microsoft. And the reason being is because they've always historically had a lot of cash, and they buy the next generation of technology.
Yeah, here's what will happen. I've been thinking about this a lot because I read the remark by Bill Gates that said his goal is to have enough money to run his company for 5 years without having any revenue. So here's the actual business tactics that go with that vision. What he's going to do is he's going to let the price of Windows go to zero, in effect, and he's going to use that the zero cost Windows as a flank guard for the Office monopoly, where he's actually collecting money from large corporate users.
Yep.
So that's what comes next.
Yep. I completely agree with that. Yep. There's just no question that the long-term survival of Microsoft staying alive through the end of the decade as a strong player is going to include a free Windows. I'm just completely convinced you're right on that. Couldn't agree with you more. So, Russ, any more stories?
Yeah, one last one. One that, frankly, I didn't get a chance to go all the way through, but what I did see looked pretty reasonable. Over at eWeek, in their enterprise app section, they had a comparison between Office 2003 and OpenOffice.org. And apparently they came to the conclusion that, OpenOffice is probably a better fit for smaller organizations, which to a large degree is probably a pretty fair statement. But by and large, at least, the stuff that I had a chance to look over here, it seemed like they did a reasonably good job of outlining pros and cons. The fact that that we're getting to this level of discussion with something like, as Eric just said, is kind of the main cash cow for Microsoft for the foreseeable future, is very interesting indeed.
Yep. The question remains whether that'll work. I read the article, followed all the logic about it in terms of it being a better fit for a small office, but I question that conclusion. And here's why. I'll throw this out. You can take it or drop it as you see fit. But let's look at the phenomenon that happened not too many years ago, okay? Let's turn the clock back 10 years, okay? We're in 1994. The dominant operating systems are DOS. Are looking at GUIs of Windows 3.1, Windows for Workgroups 3.11, a handful of Unix users out there, Novell on the server for LAN. And what was the hot office technology at the time? Lotus 1-2-3 and WordPerfect. And in terms of art creation, it was CorelDRAW. Those were the three dominant products in office automation. And where are they today? They're not here. They were completely supplanted. And the reason why they were is because the owners of businesses, the owners of very large businesses, took a look at the financial equation of continuing to make use of Corel, continuing to make use of WordPerfect, continuing to make use of Lotus 1-2-3, or getting the, at the time, much cheaper Microsoft, including significantly inferior Microsoft Office product. And the businesses made the decision to buy the products that had 75% of the capabilities of the industry-leading products because of money. That simple. I think that Microsoft is making a serious mistake if they're pinning their hopes on the fact that Microsoft Office, and I'm not saying Microsoft Office is superior. I'm saying that Microsoft is making a mistake of pinning their hopes solely on the fact that they can sell the idea that Office is superior, because it has not worked historically. Big companies, large enterprise companies, when they're looking at major dollars, they'll do the shift. And
what's interesting, Jeff, on that very, very topic is that, you know, Microsoft Office has been around for, what, how long? Microsoft Word was almost available. Well, Microsoft Word was available before Microsoft Windows. It was available in a DOS version. And
it was available in a Unix version or Linux version.
Yeah.
For a long time.
Yes. And this is very much legacy stuff being, you know, just upgraded. How can they sell upgrades to a platform? What more can they add? I mean, it's a word processor. What more can they add to it? There's not much innovation in word processing these days. I mean, the only thing they could do is maybe make the document format open. You know, that's about the only thing I can think that they can do. And so this gets to a point where, like, OpenOffice, well, it might not be as good, but the question is not is whether it's as good, but whether it's good enough.
Cue Clayton Christensen, The Innovator's Dilemma.
Is it good enough? And OpenOffice, people are using OpenOffice because it is good enough.
And surprisingly enough, it looks an awful lot like WordPerfect. That's the irony.
I used to use Lotus's word processor. What was the name of that thing? I can't remember.
Well, I'm so old, I'm afraid to tell you all the different word processors.
Oh, I've used
over the years.
Yeah, I've used KSR and ASR33s for word processing.
I used ScriptSet.
Yeah.
That was like the first word processor ever written.
ScriptSet.
It was a text editor. It wasn't even really a word processor. But I think this is an interesting article for sure in terms of it giving a side by side comparison. But it really does set up an interesting conundrum for Microsoft for the next too distant future. Let's take a very, very short break. Kevin, make it a 2 or 3 minute break and come back with segment number two. We've still got a couple of stories to talk about, in particular the Sun thread. There's like 4 or 5 articles that we really are going to handle as a group talking about Sun. And I am hoping, I'm really hoping that in the next 2 or 3 weeks that somebody from Sun will respond back to me and show up on the Linux show. I really, really, really want someone from Sun. I don't like spending as much time as we have in the last few weeks talking about Sun without giving them the opportunity to state their position. But so far,
I would sure like to hear a business plan from them that makes more sense than Jonathan Schwartz's ravings publicly reported ones.
Oh, yeah. But we'll come back in segment number two and talk about the most schizophrenic company. of the Linux Show for April the 27th, 2004. Sorry about hitting the wrong button, everybody. We sort of shut part of the stream down by accident. Shit happens, what can I say? That's the excitement with live radio. We'll just snip the two pieces of the show together later, and for those of you listening to the archives, you won't even know it happened. So, here we are, segment number two, really finishing off segment number one. We have on our site at www.thelinuxshow.com, we have a number of stories about Sun. Sun showing their true colors is the first of those stories, and that story, of course, at Grokla, kicks off a general theme tonight of things that are going on over Sun that seem to make you want to scratch your head and wonder, well, what the heck is going on over at that company? And in particular, one of the articles that we've got on our list tonight, if you haven't checked out these stories, to get the entire picture of the insanity of it all, go read them at your leisure. But one of the articles that is in that general thread is a response by one of the executives at Sun, Schwartz, doing at Red Hat, and claiming that Sun is being picked on unfairly, that Red Hat is, after all, not a legitimate open source company, that they forked the Linux source code, and that they have inserted proprietary technology into the Red Hat Linux distribution, and that it's not really open source. And of course, this is just like totally untrue. A lot of people may be upset at Red Hat because of the distribution model they've chosen to have for their subscriptions to Red Hat Linux. But if you're innovative and know how to compile a kernel, the source code is out there for you to get if you're clever enough to go get it. So they're living within all of the guidelines of the GPL. They're doing absolutely nothing wrong.
And the open source definition.
Pardon?
And the open source definition.
And the open source definition. So there's nothing that Red Hat is doing wrong other than upsetting a few people because they're not giving away that part of their work product that they have defined as their business model. And, if you're going to make money at open source, you do have to identify a business model that does fit within the GPL and does fit within the open source definition, and here's one. And it's one that has not only worked, but it's worked profitably for Red Hat. And it's a ridiculous assumption for our friend at Sun to go waving fingers at Red Hat. Hello? I don't know what that was. It was painful.
Yes, indeed.
But anybody else want to jump in on the general conversation of Sun in terms of what the heck is going on there anyway? Does anybody have an idea?
Actually, I think that there is my suspicion from various sources that I've spoken with is that there's a nasty internal political struggle going on there, which is not quite over, but that the pro-open source people are fighting a rearguard action at this point. Alas, my guess is that they probably lost the war when Schwartz was put in the president's spot.
So you, by a rearguard definition,
they're still fighting to get Java open sourced, but it looks to me it looks less and less likely that that's actually going to happen. Though I have been told that the debate is still going on.
And what about the Java desktop?
Well, you see, that makes them money, so that makes it politically more difficult for the anti-open source people at Sun to kick about it.
Yeah, well,
and after all, they didn't spend any non-recoverable engineering funds on that, or not enough of it to matter. From their point of view, the money they get from Java Desktop is gravy, because they don't have to compromise any of what they regard as their IP for it.
I'm surprised that they wouldn't consider the Java Desktop itself as being their IP.
Well, it is built on Linux, after all.
Yeah.
They're not SCO. They're not crazy enough to think they own Linux.
But in light of this new deal...
You mean the one with Microsoft?
Yeah.
I have been specifically informed by a source I will not name that we should not view that deal as having any relevance to whether OpenOffice continues to be supported and whether Java gets open source. Now, whether we choose to believe that assurance or not is another question, but that is an assurance I have been given by somebody who is inside the company.
Well, number one, OpenOffice is now an independent project, and so if Sun decides to no longer support it, I don't think it matters any longer.
Right. Seems pretty clear that Novell would pick up the slack on that. They have every reason to.
I think there's enough financial impetus within the entire Linux community to pick up the ball on keeping the OpenOffice project reasonably funded so that it can continue to move forward. Because really, at this point, as we were talking about in the last segment, you know, how good does it really have to be if it's 75% to 80% of the gadget that might be contained in Office 2003? Then really, fundamentally, the only thing that the OpenOffice project has to be cognitive of in the future is those things that Microsoft purposely breaks to make Microsoft Office not compatible further with OpenOffice. So it's from this point forward, it's going to be a game of, you know, chess, of watching Microsoft break things and the OpenOffice project fix things. We've seen this game before out of Microsoft. So that aside, if we take the OpenOffice issue completely out of the picture and we just look at the impact of the Sun-Microsoft deal on Sun and look at what they've commented about the relationship, the possible relationship with Microsoft, it leads me to believe that the Java desktop is going to be a significant fork of Linux, because it's going to start to contain proprietary Microsoft technology.
I'm not sure I agree with that, but I'm more wary of what his DRM opinions on DRM are.
What's the referent of his?
Well, they talk on Grokklaw, they talk about he's into DRM.
Now, who are you referring to? Who is
Schwartz.
I see. Okay.
Schwartz.
Boy,
but you know, like I think that the Open Office thing, and for one thing, there's Open Office org. It is an open source project. It's pretty hard to close that door. And second of all, Microsoft can try to change Microsoft Word or whatever to be incompatible OpenOffice, and I can't believe again we're back to, is OpenOffice good enough? And if it is, then it won't matter. Whether Microsoft Word is compatible or not, eventually, I think.
Well, it becomes a protocol race and a file format race.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, the next step is then to have open document formats, and and then Microsoft had to catch up with that.
Yeah, well.
So let's look at this situation from the point of view of Microsoft strategic planners. These guys live and die. They eat, sleep, breathe, and think about nothing but maintaining lock-in on their customers. So to look at this situation from the point of view of Microsoft, where is their next big lock-in coming from? They're losing the office lock-in because of pressure, especially as we covered earlier overseas, from OpenOffice. Okay? They've got a potential lock-in in Longhorn, and actually it's not going to be Longhorn anymore. It has to be Blackthorn because they've postponed the infamous distributed database file system to the next product beyond Longhorn, which is supposed to be Blackthorn. So when they get that, they're hoping to hook enterprise customers on their database file system, and there have even been some trial balloons that they plan to sell access to that database, distributed database file system, by the month. So that clearly is their next big attempt at lock-in. The question is, what are they going to do to keep their customers on the reservation between now and approximately 2007 when Blackthorn comes out?
But that's a file system, Eric.
Yeah?
Yeah. I can't believe people get locked into a file system. Could we get locked customers into EXT3? I mean, it's not...
Remember, to them, the database file system is all part of their plan to become the world's biggest ASP and actually have you store your files on their servers and rent services by the month.
Yeah, I can't believe people would do that.
Well,
given how cheap it is to do it yourself.
Well, I'm skeptical about it myself, essentially for psychological reasons. Most people can't make the ASP thing work because most customers are fundamentally territorial and want to own their own disk storage. They don't feel like they own their data unless they can get their hands on the media where it's spinning.
I saw a 200 gigabyte hard drive at Fry's the other day for $80.
Well, but the way Microsoft will pitch this is that you can reduce your TCO by buying services from us in smaller bites than a per-seat license for a conventional operating system will cost you. Of course, you'd have to be an idiot to fall for this pitch, because the moment you become dependent on that service, the price is going to go up. But that's how they'll try to sell it.
I just don't get it.
Well,
you know, I just don't get it.
Eric, you're right.
But that's even the longer-term question. The shorter-term question, the one we should be focusing on, if we want to figure out what Microsoft is going to try to do with the Sun agreement, is where is their lock-in between now and 2008? What can they get out of this deal that will assist them in retaining their customers? Now,
that's what I thought the SCO stuff was all about.
Well, yeah, but obviously that's not working real well. And by the way, I know a guy, he's a friend of a friend of mine, who's expatiated a very interesting theory to me about that deal. He thinks, and he has some persuasive arguments for this being true, he thinks that the kernel of Longhorn is actually going to be a modified Solaris.
Really?
Okay.
Yeah. Now, that may seem like a crazy idea, but turn it over in your head for a while. Remember that Microsoft has never been shy about buying technologies from elsewhere when they could use them to get a market advantage. Internet Explorer is a good example. It was originally developed by Spyglass. Okay? So they're not shy about buying technologies if it fits into their overall business plan of keeping the customer locked in. So Stu makes the argument that the Windows design, even the NT design, has reached end of life. It's become rococo. It's become rubble. They can't change it without breaking it. Okay. So they need to make the kind of fundamental step that they didn't quite make when they went from a wrapper around DOS to NT. And Stu thinks that what they're going to do is they're going to figure, well, if we can't beat this Unix thing. We got to join it. We got to embrace it. We got to extend it. And that means finding a Unix kernel that we can use as a foundational basis for the next operating system. Stu Green thinks that this is the real meaning of the Sun Microsoft deal, that what's actually going on is Microsoft is buying Solaris technology for Longhorn.
Wow. Hello?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Everything went quiet. I think that's...
You're all trying to digest this concept. But again, look at it from the point of view of a Microsoft business plan.
That's silence type.
Yeah. Look at the point of view look at it from a Microsoft strategist's point of view. They got to know that they've got huge amounts of code in their present OS code base that simply isn't maintainable. In a lot of cases, they don't have the source anymore because it was generated with development tools that they no longer have. This is a fairly open secret about a lot of their code. So what are they going to do? At some point, they got to dynamite the rubble and build something that's actually competitive with Linux. How are they going to do that? The answer, Solaris.
I tell you, if that's true, it's brilliant. It really is brilliant.
I'm not sure I completely believe this, but Stu makes a convincing case.
If that was the case.
Yeah?
If that indeed was the case, why would they not be able to deliver on the SQL-based file system? I think that would be a relative slam dunk if they were already buying a kernel like Solaris that was so
okay.
Already compatible with so many different kinds of SQL that it's got it coming out of its ears.
Remember the characteristics of their development team. They've got a lot of guys. They tend to hire people fresh out of college. And the people tend to burn out quickly and leave. Okay? So what does this give you as a sort of skills profile in the development team? They've got a lot of guys who have tremendous amounts of energy and ability to work the 8-hour a week. What they don't have is a lot of skills at building architecture. This actually should be obvious from the software they put out. If they had people who were good at fundamental architectural design, well, I mean, the rate of worm cracks would be lower for starters.
Oh, that's definitely true.
So you have to look at this in from the point of view of the software development capability they know they have. The hardest thing for them to do, the absolute hardest thing for them to do, is to take two different architectures and merge them.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that to me, this is more viable than the idiot scenario that you proposed earlier in the conversation. From the standpoint that Microsoft has always been extremely successful at selling idiot scenarios. Windows 2000 is one of them. They have been tremendously successful at selling a product that is so totally easy to install by just clicking a couple of buttons, and so full of 1,000,001 security holes, but people don't care. They think, oh, I won't get hacked, So Microsoft has been very successful at selling idiot solutions in the past. So I don't know. I think this is a more viable track. It's certainly something that I'm going to take some serious interest in. I'd like you to get me hooked up with that guy, Eric. I'd love to talk to him. It's a very interesting hypothesis.
I'll see if I can dig up his email address for you.
I mean, I don't often get stunned like that. That caught me off guard.
Makes a perverse kind of sense, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, it really does. In a very, very sick way, it does. It is 21 after the hour. I do want to bring in one more story before we jump over to segment number two. Segment number two is actually going to be fairly short in nature. And, Eric, I'd really love to get your comments on segment number two.
What, I haven't thrown enough grenades yet?
Good throw. But anyways, the last link on our list under the story links is a link to the Linux Business Directory. This is actually put up by one of the listeners of the Linux show, Adam, at Linux Itch. I'm sure you're, many of you who are in the IRC of the Linux show have talked to Adam from one time or another. But he is starting up a new Linux Business Directory. He is now on version 2 of it. He put up a sort of a weblog type of version a couple of weeks ago and has recently put up something that's a little different and looks a little easier to navigate. So everybody, if you've got a business that's presently doing business within the Linux community or doing business to businesses, that's a Linux service or product, why don't you stop by Adam's site and sign up, help him out, help him get his site designed and finished off, and participate in the continuing growing little web portals that seem to be growing up around the Linux show. So welcome Adam to the family, so to speak. Segment number 2 is political action. Can geeks get motivated? And there's a couple stories out on the site tonight. Both of them are from the AP Wire that I'd like people to take a look at. And the first one is a story about the Senate banning the internet tax. And I don't want you to jump to the conclusion that I'm somehow against this idea. I love the idea of the Senate banning internet taxes permanently. Boy, I would love it if they banned all taxes, wouldn't you, Eric?
Indeed.
I would like to see every kind of tax go away, except for the one that maybe funds the army. That's the role of our government.
Nah, you hire assassins for that. They come much cheaper.
Yeah, that's true, I suppose. But then there's a second story on there, also from the AP Wire, about Bush trotting out his broadband and technology platform to his campaign. Now, these two stories are a couple of sort of linchpin stories to a number of things that are going on in Washington, D.C. right now. And from time to time over the next several weeks, I'm going to bring up another one of these linchpins as they come across. Because there's some important things happening right about now. We're about to hit May. Next week is May. And so November, the election, will be upon us much quicker than people think it is. The two political parties are forming their platforms as we speak. These kind of stories, these stories talking about Senate debates, the trial balloons, the various technology platforms, the parties really haven't got their platforms set in stone yet. They will not set their platforms in stone until the conventions happen this summer. Now is the time for people to have serious and significant effect upon legislation as individuals. Now, a lot of people always throw up their hands up in the air and say, what can I as an individual do? And a couple of weeks ago on the Linux show, we had a guest who was one of those people a couple of years ago who threw up his hand and said, what am I going to do, until he realized that the FCC was legislating his small mom-and-pop business out of existence. And he became motivated and did something about it. He started not campaigning, but he started lobbying to his representatives, and he also hired a lawyer and went out and sued the phone company. Actually, in his case, he sued his local cable company. But things can be done. I'm not saying you have to go out and you have to sue anybody right off the bat, but you do, as individuals, have a lot more power than you think you do during a political season. This is probably the six-month period out of every four-year cycle that you have the most power as an individual. So I'd like you to take these two articles as a starting point and start looking at some of these articles that are not necessarily going to show up in the technology news. And don't buy them at face value. You're going to really have to look at them and research them. And you need, as supporters of open source and as supporters of the greater internet community, you need to get yourself a little bit more motivated. This is a critical time. If you haven't heard yet, Senator McCain is going to be stepping away from chairmanship of the Telecommunications Committee. And McCain does not, ironically, happen to be a very good friend of the Internet. McCain has been often a supporter of large phone companies and large cable companies, but he has laid a gift word on the countertop of free speech, and that gift horse he has laid down is he has announced to his committee that he's reopening debate on the 1996 Telecommunications Deregulation Act, which is probably the most significant thing for any senator to say in the last several years when it comes to the Internet. You have a golden opportunity out there if you'll start to get motivated. And I'm starting to wonder, after the last couple of years of trying to get people motivated, if it's possible. I don't know whether it's that we feel too close allegiance to one party or another, or it's just our personal lives, or if it's been the economy. But for some reason, for the last 2 years, it's been almost impossible to get people motivated on political issues. I got to give the audience of the morning show a little bit of credit and not, you know, beat you guys over the head. Because a couple weeks ago, when we had Jim Pickrell on the show as a guest, I actually raised a few bucks. I raised $150 for him and to continue his lobbying effort. But I'm a little bit surprised by the number of people that I have talked to, the number of news portals that I have talked to. Just no one's taken the effort. And I'm really starting to wonder why. Starting to get this.
Jeff, I can tell you why.
Well, tell me why, then.
Because a lot of hackers think that politics is a game you can only lose, never win.
Well, you know, Jim Pickrell's proved it can be won.
Look, whether this is actually true or not is not the point. The point is that's everybody's instinct.
Yeah, but you know, we've got to try. And for people, and I don't want to beat up anybody, so I'm not going to give any names, but for people who own major portals that are the quote-unquote voices of our community, to not bother posting political stories, it boggles my mind. It just boggles my mind that they don't do this, that they that they won't get active. And maybe you're right, Eric. Maybe you are. Maybe they feel it's an unwinnable battle. But I tell you, it's not, especially at a time like this. There is no Democrat, there is no Republican that when you sit down in front of them is going to admit that they are in favor of big business over entrepreneurial America. That would be a disaster for the re-election. Now, they may believe that secretly, but they're never going to publicly admit it. And holding people's feet to the fire is so vitally important, because people will not take the interest to make two phone calls or three phone calls, one to your congressional representative and two to your senators. I'm sorry, but if you won't take the time to make those phone calls, then we deserve to lose the internet. We might as well just hand the keys over to Disney now, because we're in effect granting permission of our government to do that. And I tell you, the platforms are forming up right now, as I speak, and everybody in D.C. Everybody behind the beltway inside of D.C. all they're talking about is broadband distribution. That one singular number is all they care about, broadband distribution. And they have been listening to the phone companies and the cable companies telling them for years and years and years and years that it all comes down to one issue: give them control of the network, and there will be broadband distribution. And that is the trend we're battling, and it's really serious that people get politically motivated during this particular season. I do have a donation button up on the website. I am not asking listeners of the Linux Show to click on that button. I am asking you to tell people that you know about that button. There are people out there, like Jim Pickrell, who are bankrupting themselves, flying back and forth to Washington every couple of weeks. There's been a little loose-knit group called the National Internet Alliance that's just been formed up. That group, it's not even incorporated yet. That group is going to be meeting down in Louisiana in May, try to get organized. It's probably going to take another 3 months for them to really get fully organized. 3 months from now, the conventions will be happening. So it's too late to wait 3 months. You got to act now. You got to start pulling money out of your pocket, make phone calls, get motivated, and do the right thing. If you love the internet, if you love open technology, you need to get active. Anybody else want to make a comment on this before I end? Anybody?
Yeah, nope.
Coward.
I already shot my mouth off. I'm going to keep it shut now.
Well, I'm glad you said something. But I feel a little frustrated, Eric. I think it's pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
But I've spent the last 2 years trying to get people politically motivated. It just hasn't worked. And the cable companies and phone companies and Microsoft, and they're continuing to grow stronger politically, and we're continuing to grow weaker politically. And the reason why it's happening is just no one in our community is doing the job. Well, I shouldn't say no one. There are real stars out there. Grocklaw is a star.
And this is why, by the way, I dispute your belief that we're growing weaker politically. We didn't have anything like Grocklaw 2 years ago.
We didn't have anything like Grocklaw two years ago, Eric. I'll agree with that. But until we have people in Washington, D.C. lobbying, we're not going to get the job done. That's the reality.
Maybe I'm a cynic, but even if we do have lobbyists, it seems to me like the best we can do is prevent damage.
I don't know if
it's hard to motivate people when that's the only upside.
I don't believe that's true.
Okay. I mean, maybe it's not true.
I honestly believe that.
Lay out the political program you think we should be supporting. Your statement is get active or we'll lose the net. Be specific. You're asking your listeners to go to their friends and say, donate money, get involved in causes, but I'm not hearing any specifics.
Well, I think it's primarily because I'm preaching to the choir. I think I've been preaching the open network concept for years, and that that's what we as Americans need to advocate.
So get specific. What do you want legislators and regulators to do?
It's quite simple, really, fundamentally, is segregate off the last mile transport let's not even call it the last mile. Let's say segregate off the last the central office down transport as an independent corporate entity. And the arguments of the phone companies saying that they cannot make money off of central office business is terribly fallacious and just total lies. Give me the central offices. I'll be glad to take them off the phone company's hands if they're losing so much money off the central office business. I'd be happy to take it.
Are there real-world examples of companies that are purely running central offices and making a profit?
When you go out into rural communities, there are. There are rural communities out there that have recently given up on the phone companies and have built their own central offices. And once they've got their own central offices and their own community net built, then they go to the content providers and say, "Do you want our content on your content on our network?"
So, I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a moment. What, as a techie considering becoming politically active, why should I walk into the maw of the political system, deal with legislators, deal with politicians, deal with lobbyists, when I can end run this whole problem by helping develop wireless mesh networking?
It's real simple. That's a good idea. And if you listen to Michael Powell, really what Michael Powell wants you to do.
Yeah.
But number one, I would never trust Michael Powell. And I have lots of reasons I can cite for that, but we don't have the time to go into that tonight. But the second issue is, eventually, that could come back. Once you've actually built the technology and made it a profit center, that does not stop the government from coming back in 5 years and from auctioning off those frequencies. And what will happen when those frequencies are auctioned off?
But you see, doing that with establishing wireless mesh networking as the way that last mile delivery gets done would change the political landscape, because the regulators, the politicians, would know that they would be pissing off a huge number of people who vote if they auctioned off those frequencies and made that channel unavailable. See, this is, I'm playing devil's advocate here.
You're right, but you know, they did that. They in effect did that to close to 8,000 internet companies already. The federal government legislated somewhere around 7,800 internet companies out of business already.
You're talking about the internet radio fiasco?
No, I'm talking about they're a portion of those companies. Okay? I'm talking about collectively, if you looked at the impact of the 1996 Telecommunications Deregulation Act and the clout that gave to the phone companies, combine that with the FCC regs with CARP and the RIAA settlement being backdated to 1997, those two actions collectively can account for about 7,800 companies going out of business. It's very simple. What happened within the internet industry is that the small community-based ISPs built an industry, and that industry was handed to the phone companies. It was taken away from the small and regional ISPs and handed. Now, does that mean there are no regional ISPs and small community ISPs? No, there are about 1,800 of them still left. To make your previous comment have some validity, Eric, just said that you are aware of what's going on right now is the best count right at the moment of with or wireless ISPs is that there are approximately 4,000 wireless mm-hmm. ISPs. And right now, the wireless ISP industry is in a panic because there is already some talk of auctioning off the spectrum. Because once again, hey, they proved the business will work. It's not as good as DSL. It's not as good as cable. But it works in a lot of applications.
It works well enough to put competitive pressure on the DSL and cable providers.
Perhaps, yes. Perhaps. But it's certainly not competitive. If you're going to go head-to-head with a cable company and with a phone company, a WISP mesh network is not what I would choose
mm-hmm.
to compete with them.
No, I'm pursuing this subject because you're trying to understand why you've had trouble mobilizing politically people to be politically active, and I think I'm explaining that. From the point of view of a lot of techies, political activism is not the least effort way to get us what we want.
Perhaps.
Now,
perhaps.
If you want people to be politically active, somehow you have to change that perception.
Yeah, well, that's true. Because I tell you, Eric, what's going to happen is they're going to legislate away the frequencies. As soon as it gets really worth the while for the phone companies and the cable companies to own it, they're going to pressure the government to auction off the frequencies.
So, okay, but this is an argument that proves too much. You're saying you can't win the political game because guesses.
I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that. We would lose that political game of preventing the frequencies from being auctioned off if people continue being non-political.
Mm-hmm.
If they continue just rolling over. We can only win by doing both.
Well, you need to make that argument more effectively in public than you apparently have.
I guess. Well, it is 9:44, and this has been a long show. Thanks for hanging in there, everybody out on the internet. We will be back the same time next week, and. Well, who knows? Maybe I'll get my argument together by then. We actually have a guest next week. We will for the next three shows be having guests. So make sure you stop by next week at www.thelinuxshow. This has been the Linux Show for what is the date? My calendar.